Hello, everyone, and welcome to Litigation Radio. I'm your host, Dave Scriven-Young. I'm a commercial and environmental litigator in the Chicago office of Pecor & Abramson, which is recognized as the largest law firm serving the construction industry with 115 lawyers and 11 offices around the U.S. On this show, we talk to the country's top litigators and judges to discover best practices in developing our careers, winning cases, getting more clients, and building a sustainable practice. Please be sure to subscribe to the podcast on your favorite podcasting app to make sure that you're getting updated with future episodes. This podcast is brought to you by the Litigation Section of the American Bar Association. It's where I make my home in the ABA. The Litigation Section provides litigators of all practice areas the resources we need to be successful advocates for our clients. Learn more at ambar.org/litigation. On today's episode, we are proud to feature two successful litigators who have been involved in a critical project for the Women Advocate Committee of the ABA Litigation Section. In 2017, the section published a collection of stories of women lawyers entitled Her Story, Lessons in Success for Lawyers Who Live It. Another book, Her Story Book 2, which tells the story of women across the country about overcoming obstacles, was just released. Our first guest is Teresa Beck, who is a co-editor of both books. She is managing shareholder of Arizona and Nevada and co-chair of the Diversity, Equity, Inclusion, and Belonging Committee at Kleindienst PC. Teresa has litigated and supervised the litigation of hundreds of civil cases, representing a wide variety of clients in employment-related litigation, personal injury defense, lawyers' professional liability, construction matters, contracts, and civil litigation of all types. Teresa, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much. It's great to be here.
And our second guest is Claire Gibson, who's the author of one of the chapters in Her Story Book 2, entitled Recognize the Obstacles Ahead, A Deeper Dive into the Statistics Affecting Women and Women of Color in the Legal Profession. She is an intellectual property partner in the New York office of Dunlap Bennett and Ludwig PLLC. Claire counsels production studios, cosmetics companies, food distributors, clothing designers, and musicians, among others, in establishing, protecting, and preserving their trademark rights both in the U.S. and abroad. Welcome to the show, Claire.
Thank you.
So, Teresa, tell us about the Her Story Project and how the books came into being.
So, going back to the first Her Story book, the Women Advocate Committee meets regularly and developed a work-life management committee. First, it was called the Work-Life Balance Committee, and then we decided we didn't really like that word balance, changed it to management, which sounds like something we can control better. And among ourselves and in the other women's groups that we're involved in across the country, we realized there were a lot of younger women especially who are wondering if they're going to be able to have outside interests, to have families, how are they going to do it? And, you know, getting a lot of feedback that maybe it wasn't possible. And we knew in our group that it is possible. And we know a lot of very successful, happy women lawyers, not always easy, not always perfect, certainly not, but a lot of positive stories. There were also a lot of kind of negative stories at the time, too, women attorneys who were saying, if I knew what it would be like, you know, I would never do it again. But we know a lot of women attorneys whose eyes light up when they talk about their careers, who love their jobs. And so we wanted to spread stories about work-life management and things that women attorneys can do to manage their work life and their home life and their outside interests and as much as we can to have all the things that we want in our lives. So that was the first book. Then we decided we wanted to do another book. And this time we decided to make it about obstacles that women face in the profession. Work-life management is one of the obstacles, but there are a lot. And Claire's piece actually kind of sets the stage for, in fact, many of the essays in chapter one set the stage for the condition of or the status of women in the profession at this point and the fact that there are obstacles. And then the subsequent chapters go through the different obstacles that women face where they tell their own stories about what they've experienced and what they've done and what they suggest and give hope and inspiration to other women attorneys who are going through the same things.
Yeah, Teresa, what I love about the books is they really do have like a cross-section of lawyers. So different races, different practice settings. How did y'all go about kind of selecting who would be an author and their particular stories?
Well, we kept track geographically. We wanted to make sure we're capturing a cross-section. And we also reached out to people we know, to our friends. And as it happens, the women who were involved, the co-editors, Alicia Menendez and Shayna Steinfeld, we know a lot of different types of women all over the country. And so just, you know, tapping into the networks that we have, we came across this amazing wide range of women in all different types of practice groups, and lawyers and judges, government lawyers, corporate lawyers, and like you said, different racial backgrounds, ethnic backgrounds, LGBTQ+. We even have a story of a person who identified male who transitioned to female and talks about how different things were after her transition. So that's how we did it. We just tapped into our networks and the people that we know.
So Claire, I guess the question after all these years is this, why is this still a problem? You know, you walk into a law school classroom, you'll see a large representation of women in the classroom. And yet we still see obstacles that women face in the profession, and enough stories to include a whole book about it. Claire, tell us a little bit about the statistics and why we are still seeing a problem here.
Well, you hit the nail on the head. When you are in the law school classrooms, 54% of law school graduates are women, right? Those numbers are great. When you look at incoming classes for law firm associates, 47% are women. Again, numbers look great. Unfortunately, that's about where the equity ends. When you start looking at non-equity partners, only 31% of those are women. The numbers are even smaller when you start looking at equity partners, and then we drop down into 20%. When you start looking at compensation disparities, we know in this country that there is gender disparity when it comes to compensation and income. And the same is true in the legal field, despite the fact that we're all doing the same work. Women associates make $25,000 less than men. As you climb the ranks in the legal field, again, you're looking at $130,000 less for women equity partners as opposed to male equity partners. If you do a deeper dive further and start including race and ethnicity demographics for law school graduates, white law school graduates, there's a median income boost of about $40,000. Whereas for Black law school graduates, you're looking at only an income boost of about $30,000. And that's at the graduate level. That number, again, exponentially increases as you start climbing the ranks. The why of it. And of course, I have my opinions. You will see sociologists talk about this. You will see other people who are, you know, have been in the legal field for a long time have their hypotheticals about the why of it. But one of the stats that I discuss in my essay is the fact that 79% of male attorneys believe that their law firm has been successful in advancing women and women's careers, whereas only 45% of women agree with that. So you've got women who are on the receiving end of this gender disparity who clearly see that this is still an ongoing problem, whereas our male counterparts think that, you know, we're well on our way to a solution. And the fact of the matter is that what success looks like when it comes to gender equity in our profession, the definition of success needs to be set by women. It cannot be set by men. And for that to happen, there needs to be an ongoing conversation. There needs to be discussion among the genders. There needs to be a platform and space for women attorneys to speak about the realities of what it is to be a woman in this profession.
And that's interesting because you often see diversity, equity, inclusion committees within law firms. Teresa, I know that you lead that committee at your firm. Tell me, I would love to get your opinion, Claire, and then Teresa, as to how successful those committees have been. And I don't mean just at your firm, but I mean, you know, profession wide. Have you seen an impact that those committees have had, and why do you think we just haven't made that connection between a definition of success where women are seeing a disparity and men don't necessarily see a disparity? So Claire, we'll start with you and then Teresa.
Well, if you look at the stats going back over the last 10, 20 years, those are improvements. Those abysmal numbers that I just mentioned, those are actually drastically improved from where they were 10 years ago. So are we moving in the right direction? Incrementally, yes. So I would say that, you know, the DEIA committees that you are seeing in law firms have been having some impact. However, we're still obviously not at a point where we're anywhere near equality at all, moreover equity. Now, in terms of where we are today, if you've been, you guys, everyone, litigators, paying attention to the current landscape, in the last year alone, we've seen a number of very large law firms be attacked for their DEIA programs. Now, where are we going to be in 2 or 3 years with those same numbers? We might end up actually taking a step backwards from where we are now.
It's such a complicated problem. And I think a lot of the issues that women and women of color even more face is the kind of systemic ingrained bias that many elements of the profession have. And I think what can even happen is in the statistics that Claire just mentioned, there were 45% of women who didn't agree that their firm was doing well. But then I wonder about the 45% that, or whatever number that would be, 45, whatever the number is, of women who think they're doing, their firms are doing okay. Do they know? Are they aware? Or do they think that their failure to succeed, to move up the ranks, because so many women don't, it telescopes from wide into smaller in terms of the number of women who get into the top tiers of the profession, you know, or do they think it's a problem with them? Right? That there's some failure that they have as to why they're not succeeding. So it is really, it's a tough problem that has to be attacked in many ways. And I mean, I guess one of the best examples I have is my firm just got Mansfield certified, which is a program of the Diversity Lab. And that's a commitment to consider at least 30% diverse candidates for every position that we have, among many other requirements. So I think that's progress. It's progress, at least for my firm. The problem is that even back in 2015 or 2016, when the National Association of Women Lawyers put out a statistic that at the current rates, it wouldn't be until the year 2181 that women would achieve just 40% equity partners at the current rates then. And I'm not sure that the rates have stayed the same as they were back then. I think that with COVID, we lost some female talent. So there's much work to be done. And I think one of the greatest motivators is all that talent that we're not using, that we're not tapping into, that we're not celebrating and helping to succeed, can dramatically change the trajectory of law firms and the legal profession and make all of us more successful by looking at what the obstacles are and taking action to try and remove them.
And what I think is so important about the books, especially the book two, and you mentioned this, is, you know, women sometimes, I think anyone believes that, you know, I think attorneys kind of blame themselves a lot. I know I do that in my own practice, right? And you think that something that is happening to you is just happening to you and it doesn't happen to anyone else. And to show what obstacles other attorneys are facing in the profession, and then you realize, oh, it's not just me, it's the profession, or it's my firm, or it's men in general, I don't know. But it certainly, I think, helps the reader kind of understand that it's not a me problem. It's an outside problem, perhaps.
Absolutely. It shines a light, right? It shines a light. And I agree. That's why stories are so important. And I just think that all women attorneys should be sharing their stories. Share it somewhere. Tell somebody what you're going through and what you're doing. And, you know, consult and talk, because when we don't talk about it, we're contributing to hiding the problems. So yes, I agree. The storytelling is super important.
So Claire, tell us a little bit more about the statistics, and specifically, what are the challenges that women of color currently face?
So those numbers are actually even more abysmal than, and when you're looking at the broader population of women in the profession. So only 4% of non-equity partners are women of color. And by women of color, I am incorporating women of all diverse racial groups, ethnic groups. So that would be, you know, Black women, Asian women, Hispanic women collectively. Only 4% of non-equity partners are women of color, and only 3% of equity partners are women of color. So you are looking at numbers that are extraordinarily small. And keep in mind what the general population looks like in terms of women of color. The numbers are extraordinarily small, and there is significant underrepresentation. On the flip side of that, and Teresa just spoke about, you know, us having lost a lot of women talent during COVID. Even before that, the numbers showed that 70% of women of color attorneys reported leaving or considering leaving the profession. And when you start digging into the why of that, one of the authors that I cite in my essay in the book is Dr. Tesde Malaku. And she talks about, she has a really good book, which I think is a good companion book for her story too. And the title of her book is You Don't Look Like a Lawyer, Black Women and Systemic Racism Within the Legal Profession. And she talks about the invisible labor, the additional taxes that women of color pay for inclusion into the social professional space that is the legal profession. And what it comes down to is we have to address a problem, you have to acknowledge that it exists, right? And when you look at the history of the legal profession, and we don't even need to go that far back. We can look at 50 years ago. We can look at 60 years ago. The legal profession, the social aspects of the legal profession, the advancement within the legal profession, when we're talking about traditional promotion practices, training practices, just the social professional culture, was established by white men for the benefit of white men, right? And so when you inject women of color into that environment, when you, Black women especially, we're on the opposite end of the spectrum socially, politically, when it comes to a comparison with white men. And so we are having women trying to navigate an environment and a system that simply was never designed for them in the first place. And so you see this constant uphill battle, this difficulty when it comes to trying to conform to these rules that were not designed with them in mind. And unless and until we start addressing and acknowledging that issue, and then looking at ways to design promotion practices, design training practices, adjusting the culture of law firms in a way that they are more inclusive, in a way that they do take into consideration diversity of race, diversity of gender, we're going to continue to see these numbers.
So, Claire, can you give us an example of what you mean in terms of institutional practices, or perhaps, you know, whatever practices within a law firm that are designed, or we're not, I guess I should say that we're not designed with inclusion in mind? You know, what are some, or what is a possible like solution to that? I'm just curious if you can give us just an example of like an institutional practice that is not inclusive. And I'm sure there's a lot, but just give us one example.
I'm going to give you two. Well, we talked about the numbers, right? So we're looking at equity partners, and we're looking at 4% of those being women of color. One of the most valuable things that as an attorney that you can have in terms of advancing your career is having mentorship and sponsorship. Very often, those types of relationships are organic relationships, right? They're based on similarities in interests, similarities in background, and having someone who can advocate for you in space where you are not makes a huge difference professionally. Now, when you have women of color who are coming from a different social background, largely possibly coming from a different economic background, different cultural background, they're going to have more difficulty building organic mentorship relationships with people who have nothing in common with them, and they're the only person in the room. I'm an IP attorney. I have been practicing in IP since 2005. I have never worked with another Black woman attorney in my entire career. And those are just the numbers. You know, only 5% of lawyers are Black. And with an IP, those numbers are even smaller. The likelihood is very possibly I will never work with another Black woman attorney. And so it becomes an additional hurdle, as explained in the doctor's book, where now you have to find a way to conform, to build an organic relationship with someone who doesn't necessarily share your gender, culture, ethnic background. And that's just one example. And I think in terms of solution, what Teresa was just mentioning with her firm, where they have acknowledged the problem and then made an intentional commitment to hire and advance and do what they can to advance women and people of color, will make a difference. We can't pretend as if this is not a problem and that this is not happening and that it's supposed to just organically solve itself. That's just not going to happen.
I think this is really important, right? To talk about real life examples, which is what the book is all about. This is going back many years, but in a firm that I worked for a really long time, all the guys would gather and go to lunch at noon, regularly like clockwork. They would go out, they would get their lunch, they'd all come back. Sometimes they'd stay out, sometimes they'd sit in the lunchroom, but all at their own table, all together. And it just wasn't an environment that I never tried to join them. I felt excluded. I was excluded. And imagine every day the male lawyers, the young associates, and I wasn't the only female associate, but all those male associates, young, mid-career, older, they're getting this informal mentoring when they're walking over to lunch, eating lunch together, walking back, sitting in the lunchroom together. That's one level of mentorship that I never got. I never got to feel like I belonged in their group. And obviously they didn't think I did either. That's part of it. There's also the experience that other people in the firm had, because legal secretaries, paralegals, the other lawyers, the other women attorneys, they could see that they weren't included either, that we weren't being included. And I think that leads to an understanding about where the women in the office stood in the firm. You know, we just weren't as important. Another example I have, and this is something that drives me crazy. I think that every time I'm at some kind of a lunch or dinner with a woman of color, whether she's Asian, American, Pacific Islander, whether she's Black, Indigenous, somehow the conversation is going to be about their country, their ethnic origin, and whether people have traveled there, or there might be discussion about hair. It just drives me crazy. And I think that it's typically the male lawyers in the group that are driving the discussion. I think it's a way of trying to make the person feel like they belong because they're talking to them, they're inquiring and finding out about them. But nobody talks to me about coming from Ireland or Britain or my ethnic background. Nobody ever talks about my hair, at least not male attorneys in this context. So I think that there's these little things that people do that make women in general, women of color in particular, feel like they're other than. Right. And so we want to be in a group where we belong, not for people to make us feel like we're different from everybody else. So let's just talk about the same things that you talk about with everybody else. And of course, there always seems to be discussion about family and children. And I love talking about my family and my children. But if that's not something that you would generally talk about in these groups, then let's talk about something else. Let's talk about, you know, the next big client we can all go after, how we can improve our processes, what we like to do, who we are as human beings, which is more about our gender or more about things other than our gender. And of course, our backgrounds are hugely important. We want to be seen. we want to be seen, but that doesn't mean that that's what the topic of the conversations should be when we get together. And Claire, you might have more ideas about that. You've probably experienced it more than I have, but it's something that I see that really others people and men and women of color. I think that's something that we can all work on.
Yeah, I've had the hair conversation. I just literally uninvited, wasn't interested. I, as a junior associate, I had a managing partner and he, very well-intended, like you said, was the goal for him, I could tell, was to try to make me feel included. But the effect is being othered because I'm the only associate who is going to have a conversation, apparently, that needs to have a conversation, apparently, about my hair to let it be known that it is okay that I have an afro. Those types of things are ongoing. I don't even know where to start with those. For me, it is just as problematic, if not more problematic, to pretend that there aren't different experiences for women of color in the profession. I like to think that having a direct approach to acknowledging and addressing an issue is the most effective approach. However, I think that law firms have not managed to do that in a way that allows and creates a space for women of a color attorneys to just be attorneys and practice law. I'm hopeful that as we have, you know, stories like the stories in this book, and as we have an ongoing conversation, that things will continue to improve. However, I think that for law firms that pretend that this is not an issue, they're doing a disservice to the profession.
There's a lot of learning that needs to take place, right? There's still a lot of learning that people need to do, and we've got a long way to go.
Yeah, a ton of learning. But I think the book is a step in that direction because not only is it good for women to read the book, but also for men to understand. That seems to be an important revelation as well, Teresa.
I love the idea that the book is for guys too. We kind of primarily think it's for women so we can, you know, give this advice and share these stories. But I do think for men who really want to understand the way that women experience the legal profession and really, I think, the world in general, this is a great book to read to get all kinds of stories about how it's really quite different for women than it is for men. And there's a lot of learning that could be gotten from reading the book.
I just want to quickly get to some of the tips that are in the book. As I mentioned, Her Story 2 is chock full of tips to help lawyers overcome barriers in the profession, as well as those personal stories of lawyers thriving in spite of those barriers. And really, in my opinion, one of the most inspiring stories in the book is Judge Ann Martin's chapter called Drains on Personal Time. It details her journey as a litigator, judge, mother of a special needs child. And we all have lives with these competing demands, right? Some we choose those demands, some demands are thrust upon us because of family situations, etc. So just what are some of your tips to navigate those situations?
I'm still learning how to navigate those situations. I definitely took a lot from the book as well, from the other authors, and just navigating life. Teresa talked about the title of the committee being, you know, work-life management. I do think that sometimes we're under some degree of delusion about how much control that we have. In this season of my attempt to balance, manage these things, I'm learning to say no. I'm learning to say no like a two-year-old weaponizes no. And it is simply that you cannot do all things at once. You can do all the things you want to do, but you can't do them all at once. And I think for women especially, we as attorneys, we aren't just women attorneys. We're women in a society that statistics show that we do the majority of domestic labor. We do the majority of emotional labor. We are the caretakers, primary caretakers for children. We are the primary caretakers for elderly parents. And when, you know, as a mid-career attorney, I'm now at the point where, you know, my parents are in their 70s. And, you know, I am also the spouse of an active duty Marine who's in, has been in his career for 20 years. And so it's how do you deal with being an attorney, practicing law, your dedication to your clients, performing well, growing your book of business, while also balancing all of these other things. And the fact of the matter is you cannot do it all. Outsource as much as you can, whether that's meal prep, whether that is a nanny, whether that is, you know, whatever that looks like. But also just say no. Sometimes you just have to say no. And as someone who kind of came up on the lean in and say yes generation, I'm learning that that's just not always in my best interest.
Love that. And Teresa, what are some of your tips?
Well, I just want to refer back to some of the authors. Lee Tart Wallace wrote about how to negotiate your compensation. Huge, huge topic for women attorneys because we don't have kind of a culture of knowing how to negotiate for ourselves. Jennifer Olmedo Rodriguez wrote about building a book of business and how to do that, which is very important for many of us. Jessica Blaymeyer, she wrote about becoming a sober female lawyer. She wrote about alcoholism in the profession, which is a huge problem. Brooke Welch wrote about mental health problems. All of these things are things that women that we know, men and women that we know, are struggling with. And so knowing that there are other people in the profession who have overcome these challenges is such a wonderful thing and a blessing. Mikhail Roxon wrote about multiple identities. So LGBTQ+, female, and all of the challenges that that can create. And I can just go on and on. There's so many amazing stories. And then each chapter, the book is broken down into chapters with the different obstacles, ends with discussion questions. So it's a great book to have, as well as Her Story One, for book club or kind of reading events. So you can trigger a dialogue with discussion questions about these topics. And I don't mean to say any one of these that I didn't mention isn't fabulous. They're all great. Every single one of them is an important story to be told by each of these authors, including a couple of guys. Stephen Velke wrote about what men can do to make a difference for gender parity. So each one is a treasure. Each one is a treasure. And there's just tons of inspiration and advice. And I hope a sense that women get when they read it, that they belong, whoever they are, whatever their differences are, whatever their similarities, that they belong in our profession and we really need them and we want them to stay. And I think overall, that's kind of one of the biggest purposes of the book is to make sure that as much as we can spread the message that women attorneys are needed in the profession and that we belong in the profession and we're making it better and we're going to continue to make it better. But we need to stay in the profession. I hope, you know, the numbers that Claire mentioned about 70% of diverse women attorneys leaving, I think that was after 10 years. I saw one study where like 100% of them left after a particular time period. And that's just a condemnation of what is happening in the legal profession that so many don't stay after investing the time and the money in the education and then joining a law firm. Imagine if we heard a statistic that 70% of male attorneys were leaving the profession. That would be a crisis. That we'd be calling for help and creating commissions to resolve, but we're not doing the same thing for women of color. And these are things that need to be addressed because it's just such a huge loss to the profession. And then to the individual stories of these people who have experienced the heartache that would have to happen for you to abandon your profession. It's just really, it's a call to action. We've had it before. We'll keep chipping away at it. But, you know, these are all stories that signify there's a lot of work to do, but a lot of positive women attorneys who are here to spread the message and make other women feel like they belong so that they'll stay.
Absolutely. And Claire, I wanted to give you the last word. Any final thoughts that you have regarding the book or perhaps a favorite tip or story from Her Story too?
I just want to piggyback on something that Teresa mentioned in terms of who this book is geared towards. I think that for a lot of attorneys, they see Her Story too, and the book, you know, wonderful stories by women attorneys, and it does create a feeling of camaraderie as you're reading this story, and it resonates. It's not just you, you know, you're hearing these stories and relating to these experiences because you've gone through many of these same things. However, I really want to encourage male attorneys to read this book. If you consider yourself to be a person who believes in gender equality, if you are among the, 78% of male attorneys who believes that the legal profession is doing what is necessary to advance women, if you are of that opinion, you are exactly the type of person that needs to read this book. And so for me, what I would like to see is the discussion sections and the book clubs that are being formed around this book. I want a lot of that to be coming from male attorneys, because that is when we're really going to see these numbers start to change.
Love that. Well, Claire Gibson and Teresa Beck, thank you so much for being on the show today.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
And if you're interested in purchasing Her Story Book 2, go to americanbar.org/groups/litigation/resources/books. where you can see all of the books published by the litigation section, including Her Story Book 2. And remember, litigation section members always receive section books at a discounted price. Thank you both for that powerful discussion. Thank you to DISCO for sponsoring Litigation Radio. DISCO makes the law work better for everyone with cutting-edge solutions that leverage AI, cloud computing, and data analytics to help legal professionals accelerate e-discovery and document review. Learn more at csdisco.com. Now it's time for our quick tip from the ABA litigation section. I'm pleased to welcome back Latasha Ellis to the show. Latasha is a litigator in the Washington, D.C. office of Hunt & Andrews Kurth, focusing on insurance coverage cases. Welcome back to the show, Latasha.
Hi, Dave. Thanks for having me.
Of course. And I understand you're going to be giving tips about preparing settlement agreements today. So what's your quick tip?
Yes. So I think when most attorneys prepare to negotiate a case or try to settle a case, most attorneys get ready to write an effective settlement agreement that optimally addresses all of the issues between the parties. But sometimes in preparing to negotiate, they may not think about some of the small nuances that will help effectuate a successful settlement agreement. And I know that we've had a number of tips in the past related to effective settlement conferences, effective mediation conferences, but I wanted to share a couple of tips about successful settlement agreements. So without further ado, I'll start with my first tip, which is to draft settlement terms for the agreement. I think that when a party settle a dispute, it is so important to record any terms of the agreement in writing so that the rights and obligations of both sides are clear and enforceable. And whether parties have reached a legally binding and enforceable agreement can sometimes be unclear, depending, of course, on how the negotiations have ensued. But certainly understanding what the parties actually agreed to is key to drafting a successful settlement agreement. So identifying the terms that the parties have agreed will help resolve the particular case. If there are any insured claims that are going to be resolved by the settlement agreement, I mean, just the scope of the release generally. And it's just so important to memorialize those terms, even if you don't actually draft the actual settlement agreement until weeks later. So the very first tip that I have is drafting settlement terms for the agreement. Of course, an effective settlement agreement converts risk, delays, and even the expenses of a lawsuit into solutions that the parties choose for themselves. So the second tip that I have is actually understanding or ascertaining the exact legal claims and parties that should be part of those chosen resolutions, the chosen resolutions for those parties. I think that when you're engaged in protracted litigation, you know, maybe it's been a long time since anyone has actually read the operative legal complaint or cataloged, which claims actually remain pending. With surprising regularity, even the attorneys of record sometimes have a mistaken understanding of the exact scope of the pending causes of action. I'm actually engaged in protracted negotiations of a settlement agreement now for this exact reason. And I think that rather than guessing, the attorneys should review the operative complaint to determine the existing causes of action and the exact identity, including the proper names of the parties to the lawsuit, and make sure to incorporate the exact legal claims and parties who are going to be part of the settlement in the settlement terms from tip number one. I think that that is so key to a successful settlement agreement, but also key into drafting a successful settlement agreement quickly and not having to draw it out for a number of weeks. So the second tip is ascertaining the exact legal claims and parties. The third tip that I'll share is determining the type of release that is needed. I mean, this seems very elementary, but it is also very important to consider the procedural posture of the legal dispute. And this is somewhat related to the last tip about ascertaining the exact legal claims and parties. Obviously, if a lawsuit has not been filed, that could be a bit of an easier, quote unquote, easier settlement. But if the settlement is intended to address ongoing litigation, a release of liability, and a plan for dismissal of the case is key. And releases come in so many different forms, whether it's releases of only the claims that are made, releases of claims made and those that could have been made, but not yet known, releases based on known facts only, releases of known and unknown claims. I mean, there's so many different permutations to what a release can look like. And again, going back to that tip number one about having settlement terms, it's important to memorialize the type of release that the parties have agreed upon so that that can be incorporated into a successful settlement agreement. So the three tips that I had were drafting settlement terms for the agreement, ascertaining the exact legal claims and parties, and determining the type of release that is needed. You know, effective settlement agreements, they help parties move, I think, beyond the so-called wrongs of the past and into the future in which their expectations and obligations are known and where the parties hope to absolve the litigation resolved based on an agreement. So it's so important to make sure that that agreement is a proper indication of what the parties agreed to.
Great tips, Latasha. Thanks so much for being on the show today.
Sure. Thanks for having me.
Well, that's all we have for our show today, and I'd love to hear your thoughts about today's episode. If you have comments or a question you'd like for me to answer on an upcoming show, you can contact me at dscribben-young@pecklaw.com and connect with me on social. I'm at Attorney DSY on LinkedIn, Instagram, X, and Facebook. You can also connect with the ABA litigation section on those platforms as well. But as much as I'd like to connect with you online, nothing beats meeting you in person at one of our next litigation section events. So please make plans to join us at the 2024 Section Annual Conference in Washington, D.C., taking place May 1st through the 3rd. The annual conference is the premier event for litigators. It brings together top litigation professionals from across the U.S. to discuss timely legal issues and the latest in trial advocacy, litigation strategy, and case management. The conference will include over 20 dynamic programs highlighting all aspects of litigation. And of course, there will be multiple opportunities to network during the programming breaks and breakfasts, as well as the welcome reception, networking luncheon, International Spy Museum reception, and the John Minor Wisdom and Diversity Leadership Luncheon. To find out more and for registration information, go to ambar.org/SAC2024. If you like the show, please help spread the word by sharing a link to this episode with a friend or through a post on social and invite others to join the show and community. If you want to leave a review over at Apple Podcasts, it's incredibly helpful, and even a quick rating at Spotify is super helpful as well. And finally, I want to quickly thank some folks who make the show possible. Thanks to Michelle Oberts, who's on staff with the Litigation Section. Thanks also goes out to the co-chairs of the Litigation Section's Audio Content Committee, Haley Maple and Tyler True. Thank you to the audio professionals from Legal Talk Network. And last but not least, thank you so much for listening. I'll see you next time.